Throughout most of the past 100 years, evangelical Christianity was firmly opposed to alcohol consumption, even in moderation. Evangelicals were heir to the righteous indignation that swelled around the turn of the century, empowering passage of prohibition. Although bootleggers and gangsters flourished in such cities as Chicago and New York, the fact remains that the decision by Congress to pass the Volstead Act and consider alcohol a debilitating drug, just as we now consider marijuana and cocaine, a generation was blessed in America, spared by the ravage of drunkenness. Seattle, where my father grew up in the 20s and 30s, was a pretty rough town, yet he never saw a drunken man until college, after Prohibition was repealed as a part of Roosevelt's New Deal. Today, alcohol, having been promoted incessantly for nearly 80 years by Jewish big media in cooperation with the Jewish hard liquor industry, is ravaging the health and happiness of countless Americans and their families, not to mention the staggering financial strain it puts on society every year. In fact, every year, America spends $220 billion. That's 2,200,000 dollars to deal with the problems caused by alcohol. Yet tragically, despite all evidence that alcohol is a very high-risk and addictive substance, the heirs of this same evangelicals who helped pass prohibition are now encouraging alcohol consumption as part as the grace and so-called liberty that comes from being a Christian. The result, predictably, is proliferation of alcoholic support groups in evangelical churches, those so-called caring churches which encouraged drinking in the first place. Somehow, having let alcohol into the front door and welcomed it from the pulpit, this so-called disease has taken possession of many believers. In this Bible study, we will present some biblical, scientific, and common sense warnings against the prevalent idea in society that alcohol, including red wine, can be enjoyed without risk. The truth is, alcohol consumption has a sordid record throughout history of leading a very sizable percentage of its consumers and their families into sorrow and wreckage. Why take the chance that you or one you love may, after only a drink or two, begin to experience alcohol's addictive powers? Jesus said that by their fruits you shall know whether something is good or bad. The abundant bad fruits of alcohol consumption vastly outweigh any possible health benefits. This should cause any responsible Christian to soberly consider another warning from Scripture: avoid the very appearance of evil. One of the members of our Truth Tellers Church is Christina, a survivor of an evangelical family which began to enjoy the so-called spiritual liberty of alcohol about 20 years ago. Such was the freedom, however, that inexorably led to the alcoholism of her father. In fact, after a terrifying drunken ride home after a so-called Christian party serving alcohol, she had to flee her Christian home ravaged by drink. She will now read her testimony, warning against the ploy that drinking in moderation is safe. Christina?
No turning back, crossing the line between moderation and alcoholism. I was 17 when I first realized Daddy was an alcoholic. Looking back, I can see the signs scattered across my childhood like billboards on I-5. Now, it seems like I should have noticed that at some point I started getting pocket change from recycling beer bottles instead of pop cans, But back then, I didn't connect the beer with the brawls, the liquor with the fighting that lasted all night. Daddy wasn't always an alcoholic. He'd drink when he came home from work, one, two, maybe three beers. As the years went on, the beer was exchanged for glasses of wine, and those for wine cartons. When he would stay up drinking all night, I would usually know about it, either by pieces of broken furniture he tried to hide in the garage, or once, the open bag of flour he'd thrown across the kitchen. Alcohol inflamed Daddy's worst weakness, anger. I lost count of the times I woke up in the middle of the night to floor-shaking crashes, heart pounding, intrinsically knowing that my safety was just as compromised as my father was. I haven't been involved in his nocturnal rages since he came after me when I tried to stop him from driving, shoving me against the front door and wrenching the cell phone out of my hands. I'm in my 20s now, and Daddy is an alcoholic who denies addiction and claims to be a moderate drinker. I haven't lived with him for over 2 years. He chose alcohol over me. Moderate drinking is a stepping stone to alcoholism. For my father, what started with moderate drinking gradually became a disease known as alcoholism. I used to look for that "he went too far" line, surveying my childhood for signs and symptoms of the addiction's progression. Somewhere around the middle, when something changed and made my dad hit the bottle double time. Now I can see that he, like so many others, never crossed any lines. He just followed them, because the only line you cross is the first one. The rest only go one way, long arrows pointing toward a uniform destination, with a few exits along the way marked, "Get out while you still can." It's a common household phrase, everything in moderation. Dieters use it to justify a small indulgence once or twice a week. Moms use it when they limit kids' TV time. Even my dad, with his sordid history of alcohol abuse, domestic violence, and drunk driving, claims it as his ticket to safe drinking. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, states that a standard drink in the United States is considered the equivalent of 0.6 ounces of pure alcohol. This amount of alcohol is typically found in 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, 8 ounces of malt liquor, and 1.5 ounces of distilled spirits such as rum, vodka, whiskey, or gin. The Dietary Guidelines for 2005, issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, defines moderation as a consumption of up to one drink per day for women and up to two drinks per day for men. These guidelines are not meant as an average for the week, and anything above these guidelines is considered heavy drinking. A common misconception is that alcohol is safe for everyone in moderation, but the latest government-issued dietary guidelines would disagree. Women who are pregnant or may become pregnant, individuals taking prescription or over-the-counter medications that can react with alcohol, individuals who plan to drive or operate machinery, individuals with specific health problems, individuals under 21, and individuals who cannot restrict their drinking to moderate levels are not recommended to drink in moderation. So, who is really safe to drink in moderation according to the USDA? Perfectly healthy men, or women with no medical chance of becoming pregnant, who are sedentary or take the bus, and who have no history of alcoholism or addiction in their family. These limitations restrict almost everyone I know from safely drinking alcohol in moderation, including myself and definitely my father. The CDC's standard alcohol amount is important to remember as well. A serving of alcohol may be smaller than we imagine. While it's fair to say that the unavoidable necessary things in life that can be damaging in excess must be moderated for health's sake, like fat, carbohydrates, water, exercise, should the same rule apply to alcohol, a non-essential commodity? The Dietary Guidelines for Americans 2010 state that alcohol consumption may have beneficial effects when consumed in moderation. However, it is not recommended that anyone begin drinking or drink more frequently on the basis of potential health benefits, because moderate alcohol intake also is associated with increased risk of breast cancer, violence, drowning, and injuries from falls and motor vehicle crashes. The risks also include a higher risk of hemorrhagic strokes, motor vehicle crashes, a dangerous reaction with over 100 medications, Some of these include Motrin, Tylenol, Benadryl, and Zyrtec. Birth defects and lower IQs in children born to moderate drinkers. Clearly, moderate drinking can have serious repercussions. Simply put, moderate drinkers are at risk for everything heavy drinkers die from. And these heavy drinkers, remember that they are anyone who drinks more than the standard set by the CDC, even if it was just once. You've heard the stories, read the tabloids, and seen the movies. The people that indulged in a harmless drink or two with friends a few nights a week and somehow let it get too far. I used to look at those individuals down my nose. I never let their destructive behavior bother me. Alcoholism was their problem, not mine. I never thought about the fact that somewhere in between the girls' night out and rehab, they crossed a line, several lines that they didn't know were there. 2 years ago, a woman named Diane Schuler was driving home while intoxicated at twice the legal limit. She drove the wrong direction on the freeway until she hit another car, killing 8, 3 men, her daughter, her 3 nieces, and herself. She had the equivalent of 10 shots of alcohol in her system when she died. Impairment of driving-related skills by alcohol has been found to begin at 0.05% blood alcohol concentration, BAC. A man weighing 140 pounds might attain a BAC of 0.05% after 2 drinks. Now, the legal BAC limit is 0.08% in most states in America, which tells us that the legal BAC limit is actually higher than the levels in which our driving is impaired. So what does this tell us about Schuler, whose BAC was approximately 1.6%? Times Magazine quotes Stephanie Wilder Taylor, author of Naptime is the New Happy Hour. On the one hand, it's easy to believe that Diane Schuler is so extreme and a crazy alcoholic. But on the other hand, according to the news, her family and husband had no idea she had a drinking problem. Her husband says he's never even seen her drunk. It would seem that there are a lot of people out there with alcohol and drug problems not being addressed due to shame or other factors, and in some cases, it leads to tragic results. As Wilder Taylor states, we can easily tell ourselves that Schuler was an anomaly or that her family was naive. Granted, not all like Schuler's end up in such a tragic loss of life, but that should tell us something. If only a fraction do, how many are out there that have secretly crossed the line with Schuler? How many men and women find themselves addicted to alcohol? No turning back. Schuler's story should shock us into reality. We become desensitized as a nation to alcohol-impaired vehicle accidents, teen drinking, even blackouts and hangovers. Losing brain cells is just the price we pay, through the nose. The loss of 8 lives due to one person's abuse of alcohol is a travesty. It should not have happened. Diane Schuler's daughter and nieces did not deserve that fate. But what are we going to do about it? Americans sigh and shake their heads in disgust. Then they leave it at that, perhaps fearing the infringement on their own moderate comfort zone. And then they go on. They meet their friends at a party and spend another night throwing up or passed out on a stranger's couch. The apathy of America to the dangers of alcohol should embarrass us. It should move us to change. Alcoholism, also known as alcohol dependence, is a condition that includes alcohol craving and continued drinking despite repeated alcohol-related problems, such as losing a job or getting into trouble with the law. If an individual experiences 3 or more of the following within 1 year, alcoholism is likely. Tolerance, withdrawal symptoms, drinking more than intended, a persistent desire to drink, inability to control drinking, withdrawing socially, recreationally, or occupationally in order to drink, spending excess time obtaining alcohol, drinking, or recovering from drinking, and continuing to drink even with knowledge of problems associated with drinking. Under the Influence, a Guide to the Myths and Realities of Alcoholism considers what makes an alcoholic start drinking. Alcoholics start exactly where non-alcoholics start. They drink for fun, for the euphoria, for the relaxation. But somewhere they cross that line and they soon appear to be inseparable from the whiskey, so to speak. But is this behavior really from a lack of morality, confidence, or self-esteem? In reality, an abnormal physiological reaction is causing alcoholics increasing psychological and emotional problems. Something has gone wrong inside. There are many factors that would increase an individual's physiological susceptibility to alcoholism, which include abnormal metabolism, preference, heredity, ethnic susceptibilities, and prenatal influences. To clarify, it is important to remember that a physiological susceptibility is a reality of the human body that does not supersede our moral choices. Acquiring or inheriting a proclivity or a disease does not mean that an individual is always faultless. Consider a smoker diagnosed with lung cancer. Is he faultless? No. His repeated choices to smoke led to an addiction that led to a disease. Alcoholic behavior begins at the same place the moderate drinker's does. In other words, whether or not you are physiologically susceptible to alcoholism is subjective, and you cannot control it. Once started down alcohol's treacherous path, you may or may not be able to return, even if you want to. Is the concept of safe drinking in moderation an accurate one? Easy. To that we can answer no, with the evidence of the risks involved alone. Is moderation giving alcohol abusers an excuse to drink with a free conscience? Well, the evidence says no, because those that are alcohol abusers are not technically moderate drinkers. They only think they are. There's a concept of subjectivity in society, this idea that we can make our own rules about alcoholism. We can define what amount of alcohol is good for us. This is, of course, within our rights as free will beings and free Americans. But the ensuing chaos and clash of standards will become a "you're drunk, no I'm not" conversation if we don't put our foot down and demand consensus. For the notion of moderate drinking to be successful, there has to be strict standards, and they have to be adhered to. The world doesn't need more alcoholics like my father, who justify each drink under the banner of moderation. Is moderation enabling people to become addicted? Emphatically, yes. Consider the other addictions we regulate access to: marijuana, prescription drugs, morphine. In medical settings, federal law requires controlled substances like Robitussin to be double locked and accounted for every 8 hours. It takes a lot of effort to become addicted to these drugs because you have to get around all of the regulations surrounding them. But alcoholics, or future alcoholics, need only walk through 7-Eleven to have access to their drug of choice. Finally, where do these people cross the line? I don't believe there is one, because the truth is that no one ever really knows their limit. If they find out, haven't they already gone too far? If one drink can push you over the edge from moderate to drunk, one extra trip to the bar from drunk to addict, are we willing to take the chance that this drink, this sip, can put us on that dangerous side of the line? Is alcohol really worth that much to us? That line between moderation and alcoholism becomes extremely blurred for many, many Americans who find themselves increasingly addicted to alcohol as their consumption and physical need of it increases. Many cannot look back over their life and point out the individual instances where they went too far, but all can look back and see the choices they made to continue their behavior. As my father could tell you, he didn't start out drinking a carton of wine at a time. He also could tell you that it was his choice to drink and to keep drinking, despite the hold it had on him. Yet my father is an alcoholic who refuses to take hold of the outstretched hand of those who would gladly help, support, and encourage him on a path to freedom from alcohol. Sadly, he has bought out shares in the idea that he can drink in moderation, safely, and with no consequences. This idea is not just a myth, a fantasy of those who like to drink wine with their dinner. It's destructive, enabling, and in some cases, deadly. Imagine how different Diane Schuler's life had been, would have been if she had not been taught that drinking in moderation was acceptable. For starters, she would still have one. And what if she had been taught that it was a dangerous drug that she should not, under any circumstances, engage with? Would she be dead? Would her daughter and nieces have lived to graduate from high school, fall in love, get married? It's too late to find out. Nobody can make choices for us. Education about alcohol, even awareness of its dangers, is only part of the equation. Ultimately, we have to be the ones to say yes please or no thank you. It comes down to one simple thing, a choice. Pick up the glass, put it to our lips, tip it back, and swallow. Or don't. We alone are responsible for that action and for the choice to do it. We cannot blame our heredity, biology, or even society for the emphasis and popularity of alcohol. In reality, alcoholics are affected by a disease they could have prevented, like the smoker with lung cancer or the homosexual with AIDS. Indeed, science has shown that alcoholics are physiologically prone to become addicted to drugs like alcohol. This is merely the reality of the body's physiological response to a drug. But liberal society, according to true victim mentality, wants us to think that these individuals can't help it. They were born that way. Liberal society paints a false reality, a picture where we are only pawns of our genes with no moral power, no principles to stand on. Imagine such a world that is subject to the whims of drugs, emotions, physical attraction, where a child molester has no control over his attraction to little girls, where a rapist is not to blame for his sexual urges, where my father is innocent of physically abusing me while drunk. No, thankfully, in every moral question or dilemma, there is always an answer, an alternative, a choice. By the grace of God, we have been given a free will. We have the ability and the responsibility to determine which lines we will or will not cross. Making the choice not to drink, to stop drinking, to be free, to save our lives and the ones we love, is one we must not take lightly. Because it's our own feet we use to cross that first definite line, the likes of which we may never see again.
Thank you, Christina. Excellent. We should be reminded again that Christina has implored and argued with her parents over this issue of alcohol in a Christian context, in the context of biblical prohibitions and warnings against drunkenness and alcohol and so on, and she's encountered terrific resistance. The idea, and this is extremely common and becoming more pervasive, and we're seeing this in other examples in some of our people who have come to Truth Tellers Church, of parents and people in the church who are drifting into alcoholism, and yet there is this illusion that it's all part of their Christian liberty, and even as they are developing an absolute need for it, they do not recognize it as alcoholism. It becomes a necessity to their lives, and so what we're seeing here today is a revolution, an epidemic within, as I said earlier, a church which a century ago was a bulwark against the proliferation of alcohol, but now is actually encouraging it. I remember watching Trinity Broadcasting probably 15, 20 years ago, the great Pentecostal worldwide TV network. And here was Paul Crouch and Hal Lindsey, and they were mocking teetotalers. They were mocking Christians who taught abstinence from alcohol. They were boldly saying that Christians had the right to drink alcohol as part of their grace. And of course, this message is going out to hundreds of millions of people in evangelicalism around the world. Now, the Bible contains a number of words for the product of the grape, some referring to its alcoholic form, and some merely to grape juice. And unfortunately, at this time, we can't get into a fascinating study of all these different words that are applied in Hebrew to wine. Suffice it to say that unfortunately, rather than emphasizing these textual distinctions, which the Bible does provide us, translators of the King James Bible set the pattern back in the early 17th century. Translators, I should mention, living in an alcohol-tolerant European tradition, simply to call most examples of the product of the grape wine, oinos in Greek, whatever. And this simplification, this convenience and simplification to call everything having to do with grape juice wine, when in fact, much of the time the Bible is simply referring to grape juice, misleads us and all of the generations following giving us permission to imbibe even the highly alcoholic and fortified wines of today. And of course, the Bible doesn't give us that permission. I'd like to just give a few verses from scriptures which powerfully warn against alcohol consumption. Proverbs 20, verse 1 says, "Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise." That's a pretty intolerant statement, isn't it? Proverbs 31, 4 through 7 says, "It is not for kings," Lemuel, which means Solomon, "it is not for kings to drink wine, not for princes, strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish." Now, we spiritually can interpret that as priests and servants, brethren of the Lord, and overseers of the flock. We are kings. We are lords and overseers over God's flock. And so every moment a Christian should be as alert, as cognizant, as sensitive to the still small voice of the Holy Spirit, and not having the buzz of liquor spacing him out, making him insensitive to opportunities to witness and opportunities to sense danger and all kinds of opportunities that come to us. So it's not for Christians. Let me just paraphrase that. It's not for Christians to drink wine, nor for leaders in the church to drink, lest they forget God's law, the law of faith, lest they pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted of this world. Give strong drink to those who have no faith in God and who are ready to perish. And then Proverbs 23, 19 through 21 says, "Hear thou, my son, and be wise, and guide your heart in the way. Be not among the winebibbers, among riotous eaters of flesh, for the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty. Drowsiness will clothe a man in rags." And in the New Testament, Titus 1 through 7 says, again, for a leader in the church, he says, "For a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent nor greedy for money." However, 1 Timothy 5:23 does express Paul's concern, and he says, "Drink no more water." He's talking to, I forget exactly who he's talking to, but he says, "Drink no more water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine often infirmities." Now, this verse has been the number one defense for wine and alcohol consumption among believers. Notice the context, however, of this advice by Paul. He's suggesting that wine be used for a medicinal purpose, for the stomach's sake and for infirmities. In Paul's time, medicine was not available as it is today, especially amongst the common man. Today, we have many drugs that can help a myriad of ailments. I must ask one question. Do Christians use wine for medicinal purposes? No, not usually. Wine is consumed for social and recreational purposes and often in excess. The message of Christianity is love for your neighbor, and love certainly ought to include not enticing or giving a green light for anyone to take the chance of becoming an alcoholic by indulging in moderate drinking, as Christine has been saying. Romans 14, 21 says, "It is good neither to eat flesh, nor to drink wine, nor anything whereby your brother stumbles, or is offended, or is made weak." Of course, we considering wine of 2,000 years ago, where you have polluted water, you have water-borne in diseases, in corrupt water wells and water holes and oases and so on, it was vital that there be some form of preserving liquid nourishment. for a camel, a caravan, whatever. And it's not. Today we have refrigeration. We have ways of keeping our food and water pure without such compromises as having to have alcohol be the antiseptic in the liquid we drink. And so there is room for, like Scripture says, in the times of their ignorance, God winked, and he allowed certain things in antiquity and in the Bible that we don't need to tolerate today, because we have a higher scientific and even educational and moral repertoire of truth to bring to all of the problems that face us. Online, there are a number of health organizations which have some very, very salty advice, counsel against alcohol. And there are so many of them that I think I'm just going to read a few of the quotes my niece Mary Ann brought me off of the internet. All very medically sound. One of them says there's a strong relation between alcohol and sexual assault. This is because the effects upon alcohol are to lower people's inhibitions, impair good decision making, hinder the ability to communicate clearly, and can increase vulnerability by making resistance to unwanted advances or assault difficult or ineffective. I remember when I was at art school back in the 60s, a couple of kids in their early 20s or late teens came to class in the morning, and I heard them talking, and without the slightest shame, they were discussing the drunken party they had been at the night before, in which they had gotten the girls drunk and they'd gone around and had sex with them in a drunken state. And one of them casually, did you blank her? Yeah, I did, you know. And it was just part of growing up. Mm-hmm. And alcohol was the way to completely neutralize female inhibitions. Mm-hmm. And the girls would wake up from their drunken stupor and their vomit, and they had no idea how many men had been on them during that party at night. That was in the early 60s.
Now they have posters up at like our colleges, and they have lots of posters about alcohol and rape. And yeah. They say, you know, just because she can't say no doesn't mean it's rape. And they have pictures of people drinking and saying.
But I think now it's so common that they do prosecute it as a rape because the woman can't consent because she's intoxicated because it happens so much.
Sure.
A lot of times.
She's unable.
A lot of times it's.
But it's not going to be prosecuted.
And she doesn't know who to turn in.
Yeah. Another quote, a survey on undergraduate revealed that one half of the males and females reported that they have used alcohol to enhance or intensify sexual experience, and that alcohol has been deliberately used in a dating situation to make one of the partners more sexually willing or responsive. Another quote, research has shown that long-term drug and alcohol abuse costs business and industry an estimated $100 billion annually. Alcoholism alone causing 500 million lost work days a year. In the U.S., more than 40% of those who start drinking at age 14 or younger become alcoholic. And this is an interesting point, because here we're talking about 40% of people becoming alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Now, they say only about 10% of the population has this so-called disease or this genetic predisposition toward alcoholism. Here they're saying that if you start early enough, you know, I had my best friend in high school. I saw him at the class reunion about 25 years ago. And he told me that he was an alcoholic as a freshman in high school. Mm-hmm. And even when I knew him and was on camping trips and everything, he had his little hidden flask of high octane scotch or whatever hidden. and he would chew gum or he would use breath mints to hide it, and became a. But he did completely dry out later on, which he was very proud of. So the statistics of young people getting into drinking, even in grade school, are alarming. As much as 50% of police work is spent. 50% of police work is spent addressing alcohol-related problems in our nation. Did all of you see this big Ken Burns feature on Prohibition that was given a lot of play about a year or so ago? And they were mocking. The whole thing was a mockery of Prohibition and the futility of trying to limit alcohol. And yet, here we have an extremely debilitating and socially destructive drug. It is costing 50% of police manpower and finances just to address the alcohol problem. And yet, it's out of the question that there be any restraint on alcohol. And we have learned our lesson that Prohibition doesn't work. Don't any of you blue-nosed, Carrie Nation people with your hatchets come after us again. That's the liberal... That's the message of the Jewish distillers and the liquor industry. And so it says this would mean that the annual cost to law enforcement agencies is at least $7.5 billion annually. According to one study, almost 11% of 8th graders, 22% of 10th graders, and 27% of 12th graders, that's seniors in high schools, report binge drinking, mm-hmm. 5 drinks in a row in the last 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. 11% of 8th graders mm-hmm. are drinking 5 drinks in a row, even before they're out of grade school. Mm-hmm. Every year, 1,400 American college students between the ages of 18 and 24 die from alcohol-related accidents and injuries, including motor vehicle accidents. Traffic fatalities, perhaps more than any other statistic, point out the devastating realities that often result from alcohol abuse and alcoholism. In the United States, during 2004, 16,694 deaths occurred as a result of alcohol-related motor vehicle crashes just 1 year, 17,000. This amount was approximately 39% of all traffic fatalities, so nearly 4 out of 10 are alcohol-related. This amounts to 1 alcohol-related death every 11 minutes. This statistic, quite honestly, is overwhelming. Talk about abuse and alcohol, 1 alcohol-related traffic fatality every 31 minutes, and the grief and devastation suffered from these deaths is beyond comprehension. And finally, alcohol abuse and alcoholism cost the United States an estimated $220 billion in 2005. This dollar amount was more than the cost associated with cancer, which was $196 billion, and obesity, $133 billion. Though dollar amounts like this are hard to comprehend, at least they make an attempt at placing a dollar value on the relationship of abuse and alcohol.
Wait, what 220, did you say?
220
billion. That was almost double the obesity.
Or is obesity and cancer together?
Obesity and cancer together,
they were 100.
No, cancer is 196 billion, obesity is 133 billion. Okay.
Which we hear about every day on TV in media, the obesity crisis. But the alcohol crisis is double the cost to the nation, and we never hear about it.
What we are finding as a family with relatives in cultures that are tolerant of alcohol, for example, my brother's wife comes from a Dutch tradition. Her father was an immigrant from Holland, and he brought the old world tolerance of alcohol here to California as a dairyman and so on. And he's passed on this tolerance and this indulgence to his family as normal. And when they go to family reunions, it's alcohol everywhere. Lots of drinking is part of the merriment and enjoyment of weddings and family reunions, etc. But what John told me the other day was that the problem is that these sons are now very, very much maintenance alcoholics. what we're finding is a resistance to the idea that, number one, that drinking is a corruption of our body. According to Scripture, our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. We do not take kindly, as real Christians, to any kind of defacement of our body, like tattooing or puncturing our lips and faces and eyebrows and things like that. We do not take kindly also to alcohol's attack upon our livers and upon our brains, the destruction of our brain cells, and so on. Obviously, this discussion could go on and on about the many, many destructive effects of liver upon of alcohol upon our body and even our cognitive centers as alcohol destroys brain cells. I don't know about you, but I need all the brain cells I can keep.
Amen.
And but there's great resistance. This idea that Christina was mentioning, that somehow I can control this. Mm-hmm. I'll do it in moderation, and I'm not going to be one of those 10% or 40% who become alcoholics. Somehow I'll be outside of that. Problem is, you're setting a terrible example for your children, your family, and if you don't become a roaring alcoholic, there's a good chance that one of your children, your precious son or daughter, or plural, your family may become devastated and also pass that on to another generation. So John has compiled 10 reasons to avoid alcoholic consumption. And this is a little list, a little letter. He, out of concern, he and his wife, Olinda, typed this up, and they sent it around to all their relations, their Dutch relations and friends, in an attempt to hold back this plague, which is not being criticized at all in the church. And John, if you need to comment on any of these, you wrote this, I'll let you do that. Any other comments, we'd appreciate that. Number one, alcohol is dangerously addictive. It's an addictive substance. Alcoholism is a major problem in society. Number two, alcohol is classified as a poison. If you want to preserve something and kill all the bacteria, you pickle it in alcohol, mm-hmm. don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why take a poison in your brain, start pickling your brain? Mm-hmm. Every drink, every single drink kills brain cells in our cognitive center where we need everything we can marshal. It kills cells in our brain, it kills cells in our body. Alcohol is the number one teen drug problem. This is because there's tremendous peer pressure to drink. Alcohol in the home is a temptation to children and teens. Alcohol is a major factor in domestic violence and family trauma. It is also a large factor in violent crime. Alcohol is involved in almost 20,000 annual motor vehicle fatalities, totaling more than all the Vietnam and Korean War casualties put together. Alcohol is a mind-altering drug. People don't drink because liquor is delicious, do they?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just love Concord grape juice. I can drink it by the gallon because it is so delicious. And even Jesus said, every time you drink that stuff, you think of me. You just think of how delicious Jesus is.
Mm-hmm.
It's sweet and it brightens my world to drink grape juice. And unfortunately, I'm not a very good witness because I have never tasted alcohol in all my life.
Most people don't drink it for the taste. They drink it because of the change.
It's the buzz.
Yeah, it's the buzz.
It makes your problems go a little bit farther away, doesn't it? It numbs your mind. It gives a glow. Now, we as Christians, where are we supposed to get transcendence from?
God.
We're supposed to get transcendence from Jesus, who is our hope, who is the only substantive hope in this world and for the next world, who and his Holy Spirit were promised to be the Paraclete, the Comforter, the one who comes beside us and shows us the way and gives us the peace that passes understanding. When we go to liquor for consolation or a time out from the realities of life instead of going to God, isn't that a form of idolatry? Isn't that going to a separate guidance or comfort system besides going to the one who made us? Mm-hmm. Alcohol is a mind-altering drug. It degrades judgment, alters realities and moods, lowers inhibitions, degrades character, morality, and changes personalities. Most alcoholics or alcoholics on the make are deceptive, and with deception comes lies, comes attempts to hide what is really going on. It degrades your character and degrades your reputation. Alcohol contributes, number 7, to poor decision making and is irresponsible. There is no such thing as responsible drinking. Each drink lowers the ability to make right choices. You know, the ability to survive in life and actually get ahead in life depends on using the brain God has given you in a strategic way, making strategic decisions, making wise decisions, making well-informed and calm decisions, and an ability to visualize cause and effect. Where is this decision going to take me? Have I made a good decision? Have I made a bad decision? Should I go forward or should I pull back? It's a form of warfare against everything that is opposing us in life. We go forward, almost a military way, to keep the laws of entropy from dragging us down into destruction and chaos. Well, if we drink alcohol, the acuity, the sharpness of those decisions are dulled. Mm-hmm. So we make bad decisions. We make fools of ourselves. We lose friends. We lose opportunities. We squander our spare time. We squander our money when we could be cognitively organizing our life in a constructive way. Most modern wines are fortified to increase their alcoholic content. On the most part, they cannot be compared to biblical wines. Alcohol's social pleasures cannot outweigh the social destruction it brings to society. It is a huge hypocrisy in society. I mentioned at the beginning of this talk how support groups are springing up in these mega churches for Christian alcoholics who have taken the advice of the Christian leaders and allowed alcohol into their lives. How can that be love on the part of the pastors? The most important point is this: why would a Christian need alcohol? As a relaxant? Out of peer pressure, for sociability? None are valid excuses to justify consumption of alcohol. The Christian is to be above the vices and hypocrisies of the world. It is the Christian's responsibility to bring truth to society and be an example of godly living. We must be dedicated to relieving the suffering in a world awash with the problems of alcohol. The Christian's example and witness is severely compromised by the consumption of alcohol. The world knows it's wrong, and if they see us drinking, it gives them an excuse to call Christians hypocrites. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is that it is a sin allowed in the life of the believer by bad, compromising theology. If a Christian is insensitive to the effects of alcohol on humanity, they will be insensitive to Christ's commands to be holy and righteous. Do you realize that this letter was sent out to quite a large number of people and was reacted to was received with anger. Even one relative basically said she would never speak to John's wife again for sending out this letter. She was so insulted at our judgmentalism on her right to drink alcohol after reading everything we've said here today. Others, in fact, I don't think you have had any relatives, have you, who responded positively to this and said, thank you for all of this truth. We're smashing our bottles, we're pouring the liquor down the drain, we're starting all over again. I don't think you've had any positive responses that I've heard of. So you see, it's a very hard sell to persuade so-called Christians. Once you get needing, once you need that buzz and you need that glow and you need it as a crutch for life, and it becomes a part of your social context, it becomes very, very difficult to pull people out of alcohol consumption and support of the idea that we can drink in moderation. Do we have any thoughts about this?
Teddy, one thing I've noticed when you bring up a concern about alcohol use to Christians is the amount of defensiveness that you encounter and hiding and denial that there's any problem that they drink, you know, maybe once a week. No, it's no big deal. There's so much refusal to even listen to the possibility that there could be a problem, and that is a huge red flag that there is a problem.
Yes, it is. Yeah. When their judgment is so impaired that they cannot listen to the facts and the warnings, you see, alcohol is deceptive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sign, the fact that they will not listen or be open to that is in fact that they're already experiencing the effects of addiction because it is so important to them. Mm-hmm. If they weren't so important to them, they would listen gladly. They'll listen to 100 different topics gladly.
Yeah.
But this is a very, very important part of their life. They need, they want the comfort of alcohol. And this delusion continues. As Christina was saying, here's a Christian family, a good, solid Calvinist family in the church, Bible-thumping Baptists, and yet liquor has become permitted originally in moderation. No, I just want to have a little bit of beer with my spaghetti. You know, just you can't deny me just a little bit of suds once in a while, and a little bit sometimes at celebration. Christian, it starts with this permission to enjoy it as part of Christian liberty. But then, as Christina says, the earmark behaviors begin to set in: the secretiveness, the anger, the obsessiveness. And so on.
Well, there's no such thing as a neutral compromise. You can't compromise your values or compromise the moral truth that God has given us without having deleterious effects, without having a downward spiral.
Yeah. I think another thing we have to remember is that, and I'm writing an article this week about Jewish control of hard liquor production worldwide. This is well acknowledged and proudly acknowledged by the Bronfmans, Shenleys, and so on. And it's very interesting that there's a selective morality that started in. Back when I was in college and art school in the 60s, everybody was smoking. But sometime in the following two decades, it started really quite rapidly. It became no longer became cool to smoke. Became a dirty, disgusting habit, and all the liberals and all the yuppies started stopped smoking, or they tried to stop smoking, and but the big Jewish liquor interests made very, very sure that this morality did not extend over to alcohol. And somehow the red wine was good, and the women's magazines were pushing red wine drinking, and even the churches were promoting it. Even certain pseudo-medical advisors were saying it was a good way to keep from having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put all this antifreeze in your system and keep the cholesterol out. And they didn't mention that you might become an alcoholic and die of cirrhosis of the liver or a car crash, even though your even though your cholesterol was thoroughly dissolved by the alcohol. But anyway, this alcohol has remained king now since 1934, when the Volstead Act was repealed. At first, Roosevelt said, well, it's just going to be beer. We'll just let beer back in. Yeah, there were people like the head of the Kennedy dynasty, Joe Kennedy, who were stocking up huge warehouses full of Scotch whiskey even before Prohibition, knowing that when it came in, the people would want the real straight, hard liquor, and how right he was. And rather than America revealing moderation with the repeal of Prohibition, America is now awash in liquor. Young people are just drinking themselves, especially on holidays like spring breaks, drinking to point of incapacity. And so it's a major problem. And one of the reasons I wanted to address it is because in our movement, in the alternative right, in alternative internet and radio and so on, alcohol is not criticized. Mm-hmm. It is not criticized. The truth of the matter is that the Jewish Hollywood film and movie and TV industries have very cognizantly and even publicly said that they are working with the distilleries to promote liquor. Mm-hmm. And this goes clear back, of course, into the movies in the 40s and 30s, as well as promoting tobacco and so on. And there are under-the-table deals that there will be lots of liquor proffered in occasions for many, many occasions in the film where liquor will be there as the sociable thing to do. And the distilleries will benefit by it financially, and the movie and movie studios will receive their financial payoff for these hidden commercials within movie productions. And so I think it's time. I am writing this article. I'm hoping it will come out first of the week, which I want to thoroughly document the Jewish dominance, Jewish role in liquor production, not only in the 20th century, but it goes way back. The Jews have been distillers going back centuries. And it's, in my opinion, it's a product of the Talmudic desire to corrupt the goyim, to tear down Christian civilization so a Judaic order can take its place.
But consumers are completely guilty of buying into that.
Of course.
And like you're saying, it has completely infiltrated all segments of society, all populations. And to me, what I don't understand is it seems so similar to the prescription drug problem that we have now. People recognize the problem with abuse of prescription drugs. That's a huge epidemic. And I've never had alcohol either, but I have had prescription painkillers, and I have a very high tolerance for them. So what they just make me feel a little bit happier, like a sense of well-being. And I understand that people want to chase that. And that's why in our household, it's treated very seriously. Prescription drugs are very, very last resort. We don't keep them in the house because people know this is a huge problem in our society. This is highly addictive. Yes, it makes you feel good, but it leads down this horrible path. I don't understand how alcohol is different. To me, it's like people taking prescription painkillers into a party, opening them and passing them out and saying, this will increase the donation, this will make people loosen up and feel better, so let's just have these pills. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between that and hard alcohol? I just don't understand why there's such a complete like double standard in how they're treated in society.
Well, we have been burned because of all of the bad publicity which the liquor industry, in other words, the Jewish media, has given to Prohibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have said now for, 80 years, they've said, don't you blue-nosed Christians ever mention again the possibility of legal restrictions on our right to push liquor down the throats of the American people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a failure. It creates crime. It creates all kinds of violence and so on. In other words, it's a failure. It never worked. It only creates a greater curiosity desire for liquor. So don't you ever, ever come near any kind of copying of the Volstead Act on you know, any legislative level. And so the church has been thrown back and basically said, well, yes, we will not. You know, we agree, that was a terrible mistake. You can never threaten anybody's right to drink or obtain liquor. And so it is not a popular idea. In fact, opposition to liquor is not a popular idea. I went into a Christian bookstore quite a number of years ago. In fact, it was probably 20 years ago. I went into a Christian bookstore looking for some kind of simple tract or book warning against liquor and the effects of liquor. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I found in the major Christian bookstore here in Portland? I found books encouraging liquor as part of our Christian liberty, in moderation. Mm-hmm. Books encouraging wine in, as a New Testament tradition, you know, Jesus turning the water into wine and so on. While this means the Christian, there was not a single book there in that very large bookstore against liquor. So we are reaping, and I'm afraid many, many churches are beginning to realize, perhaps, by the number of alcoholics they are producing, that they went wrong. They took a wrong turn, clear back, as early as the 70s and the 80s, in abandoning the historic Christian stand against liquor. Mm-hmm. So I think it's time to speak out. I've been wanting to speak out against liquor and give a talk like this for many years, and it's just a matter of priorities. But I think the time has come when we need to make an issue of it.
This is going to go out on our weekly Bible study, isn't it?
Yes.
Good.
I just wanted to add, and it might be redundant, but when I wrote the article, I was addressing my target audience was a group of, you know, secular college students. So I wasn't, and I had to be very pointed, so I couldn't go into the biblical aspect of it. But as far as, you know, you're talking about alcohol in these Christian homes, and I just think that one of the biggest problems in these settings is, first of all, Calvinism, which gives you license to drink even if you get drunk when it's not a problem, which is obviously a huge problem. But as Christians, we have to be in reality about everything, but we are always seeking reality. And the problem in these homes is that people are not in reality. They're in complete denial of what they are capable of, and as far as alcohol. And I know in my home, if, you know, what would happen would invariably be, you know, something would really go wrong. He would break the coffee table, my father, or something. And then for a couple days, it was like, okay, no more alcohol. You know, I'm gonna cut back. A week later, you know, it would be something else. There'd be a hole in the wall or, you know, something. And he lived, for as long as I've known him, in complete denial about his addiction to alcohol. And that led to his now full-blown addiction to alcohol, where he has let that separate his own child from him because he's not willing to give that up.
Yes.
And I think that the listeners, that people that drink alcohol, if you drink alcohol, you are not safe from any of the things that we've been talking about, because I just think that Christians, especially in the evangelical church, are so willing to think that they aren't in any danger of, you know, sleeping around, or, you know, I'll never sleep with my boyfriend, or, you know, they live this lifestyle that is just pushing the limits, and then before they know it, they are on the other side of,
yes,
you know, the line.
Yes,
and I guess my burden for these homes that have, I'm sure, children and, you know, marriages that are, that need reality, that alcohol, there is no time when alcohol is safe, because moderation is just like such a small amount of alcohol compared to what people actually drink. I mean, 8 ounces of alcohol, a beer is like a little cup. Okay, yeah. People drink bottles of alcohol, a beer, 1, 2, 3, 4 a night, and that, and they're not even what they consider drunk.
Yeah.
So their idea is completely skewed, and we just, as Christians, it is so important that we are in complete reality about what we are capable of without Christ, and how. I was thinking today about that verse in Romans 7 where Paul says, "Who shall deliver me from this body of death? Thanks be to God, for, you know, he is our deliverer, and we cannot underestimate the amount of power that a drug can have in our system, and that is just the physical reality. And the moral reality is that this addiction will separate us from God. And it's such a foolish thing to me to mess around with something that is a drug that can send you to hell."
That's right.
I mean,
well, that reminds me that I remember quite clearly back, I think it was probably the 70s, when the psychiatric profession started telling us that alcoholism was a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And a disease, logically, is something you catch. There's some kind of a microbe or germ or bacillus or something that gets into your system and attacks you involuntarily. But they began telling us that alcoholism is a disease, just like they were also telling us that juvenile delinquency was the result of social and economic influences. And these poor little rebels weren't really responsible for their alienation and their destruction and so on. The liberal mind is attracted to creating victims.
Mm-hmm.
Victimization. You are persecuted, you are discriminated against, you are hated, and so on. ADL, of course, plays that up to the limit. And when we call it a disease, we're basically saying that we're not entirely responsible,
mm-hmm,
for having this disease. I remember talking to a man who was dying of emphysema, and he wanted to tell me how much he hated God. He said he hated God because God allowed him to get emphysema. And a little thought was in the back of my mind, this doesn't make too much sense. But what I should have said to him is, well, God didn't make you smoke that first cigarette, did he?
Mm-hmm.
And there's the evasiveness, and it, not only are the people who are indulging in these vices evasive, but the medical establishment trying to cure them to a certain extent is evasive too.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to call sin sin.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was burned into my conscience as an early age that smoking and drinking were sin.
Mm-hmm.
Teddy and Johnny, Nancy, do not touch cigarettes. Do not go near liquor. There's a demon in the bottle, and so on. And so we were totally alienated against these from our earliest childhood. Most people don't have that kind of teaching in their youth. But the biblical standard is that, but the Bible says, I don't care how you became a drunk.
Right.
So moderation or bad teaching or whatever, if you're a drunkard, you're not going to go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Drunkards shall not inherit the kingdom of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
That means that as a social drinker, as a Christian drinker, if you go over a certain limit that Christine has been talking about here tonight, what is it, 3 beers or whatever, and start getting tipsy, you are drunk. And you can lose your soul, according to Scripture,
right,
by losing your cognitive facilities and your ability to be a witness and on duty for Jesus Christ in this world. Just one other hypocrisy. Our moral guardians in government and police and so on, say, now don't drink and drive. If you're going to drink, don't mm-hmm. drive. Well, let me tell you, if you've started drinking, mm-hmm. you've yeah. lost your cognitive mm-hmm. powers and your ability to even make a rational decision about driving. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it make more sense for them to tell people who have a tendency to drink, don't drink. Mm-hmm. Just don't drink and remain sober, remain cognitive, and you'll be a good driver. You can drive yourself anywhere. But as soon as you take that, start lubricating sin with that first drink, then I bet you can't keep from having just one more. There's that mm-hmm. there's addictive, compulsive momentum that causes us to lose all ability to make good judgments.
Well, the policemen that I've talked to, because I've known a lot working in physical therapy, they would talk about how they personally, even though the legal limit is 0.08, they consider somebody who's had one drink, mm-hmm. to be buzzed and yeah. inhibited, mm-hmm. and that they have all these signs that they watch out for, and they say that they, I don't know the statistics, people can look it up, but policemen say, you know, we are seeing problems from people who are under the legal limit, who are mm-hmm. causing all sorts of problems, uh-huh. because people's bodies, there's this man that I knew, he was like 6'5", huge guy, he could handle way more alcohol than a smaller person. The legal limit is just kind of this line in the sand, but somebody who might have just one alcohol could be totally wasted because their body can't handle it.
Sure.
And so that's what policemen, and they have all these billboards now that they show a picture of the same picture of a wrecked car, and underneath it says drunk driving, and then underneath the other one it says buzz driving. Oh. And they now say buzz driving is drunk driving.
Yeah.
And because that's how it really is. And what I was thinking about, what Verity was saying, is how Christians, I think, of any group that I've talked to about my being a teetotaler and not drinking any alcohol, Christians are the most resistant yeah. to any kind of truth about it. I was just reading about this group, this undercurrent in hard metal rock. They're called Straight Edge. I don't know, Aaron and Ryan might have heard about them. They're all these people who, in this really bad environment, have recognized that alcohol and drugs are destroying this whole generation of people. And they do not drink any alcohol, they do not do any drugs, some of them don't even take prescription medication, and they call themselves Straight Edge, and they recognize that alcohol has destroyed their generation that grew up underneath this, you know, the 60s and the 80s and everything. And then, like, even these other religions, I think Mormonism and other religions, say no alcohol because they recognize that it causes all these social problems. Mm-hmm. But Christians are like, Jesus' first miracle was turning water into wine. Mm-hmm.
And Jesus went to the bar. That's the other thing.
Yeah, he had a keg. He went to a keg party.
Yeah.
Yeah, we heard that.
Yeah. And, yeah.
We heard in a free...
All things are pure.
We heard in a free Methodist church, laughingly from the pulpit, that Jesus attended a keg party.
Right.
And so what's wrong with us going to a keg party?
Because if he was here today, he would be down at the local bar.
Uh-huh. Witnessing, yeah.
The dictionary definition of drunkenness makes no definition between just a drink and drunkenness. Mm-hmm. So if you take one drink, you're a drunk, according mm-hmm. to the dictionary.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, Jesus, the ethics of Jesus said, if you look upon a woman to lust after her, you've already committed adultery in your heart. Wouldn't that apply to drinking? If you start drinking, testing and tempting God mm-hmm. and saying, mm-hmm. well, I'm going to stay under the legal limit, or I'm going to stay moderate, but you're still not avoiding the very appearance of evil. You're flirting with evil. You are tempting the Lord. I say that in your heart, you're already a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
You're already waiting for that day when you lose your job, or you get a bad report from the doctor, or your wife leaves you, and then you're going to say, oh, the only real comfort I have in this world is liquor, is a bottle. And that's of course where if you've established a disposition or receptivity toward liquor, then you are fair game for the hard knocks of life coming and driving you in your weakness, in your stress, to the comfort of liquor rather than the comfort of God.
Well said, everybody.
Okay, any more thoughts on this?
I just had one.
Yes.
Speaking of buzz driving, my older sister was in a car accident 7 years ago, and she was walking out the door. She had one beer. That's it. She had one. And she told me that she was going to go and take care of some dogs that she had to take care of. And I told her, well, you know, I really don't think you should drive it. You know, you just were drinking. And she finally had one beer. And I let her go. I mean, I resisted, but I let her go because I was like, okay, she only had one beer. Mm-hmm. She was then in a car accident. She ran into a land wall at 45 miles an hour. And now she has a fracture in her back that will never heal. Mm-hmm. So that's buzz driving, barely buzz driving, mm-hmm. yeah. and still completely impaired enough to crash. So, mm-hmm.
yes.
One other total hypocrisy or ridiculous thing that you'll hear that I've heard so many times is people say, "Oh, I don't get drunk. I just drink socially," which is what inspired me to write this article. But they'll say. And I know my limit. I can only have two beers. It's like, if you know your limit, then you obviously have crossed it. I mean, at one point, otherwise you wouldn't know your limit.
Yes.
And so it's just this constant them lying to themselves, mm-hmm. evading reality, evading truth. And this is that's just across the board. Everyone does that. I mean, if they think they can really go to a party and just drink socially, I mean, that's just... totally unrealistic.
Well, most Christians acknowledge because of those verses.
You know, we should stop using the word Christians here so casually. Let's call them evangelicals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. A Christian is
churchgoers.
Churchgoers.
Yeah.
We're
evangelicals too. But.
Evangelicals are churchgoers because a real Christian does not tempt the Lord.
Right.
They
yeah.
do not.
Right.
They do not. Flirt around with alcohol, play games with something as deadly and threatening and addictive as this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, continue your thought.
Those churchgoers will acknowledge, because of the verses that say drunkards will go to hell, mm-hmm. that being drunk is mm-hmm. a sin.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But I have yet to meet a single person who has not gotten drunk from drinking alcohol,
yes.
and claims to be, you know, a follower of God. Well, I don't ever get drunk. Well, have you gotten drunk? Well, yeah, I got drunk, oh, like 3 times in college, but just 3 times.
Yeah.
So, like, God doesn't say if you get drunk every week on a Saturday night, then
yeah.
you go to hell. It says people who get drunk go to hell.
Yeah.
When I was in college, I remember I met these three young people that they were the most ardent churchgoers that I met in my whole time at college. They actually would sit, like, they'd make a point of sitting next to different people in class every time to try to witness to them. They wanted to convert people. They were passionate about what they believed, but they were hardcore Calvinists. And I remember this one conversation I had with them where we were talking about sin, and I was talking about how you need to avoid sin. And one of the examples that this girl used, she's like, you know, It's not possible to just completely avoid sin. You know, haven't you ever been at a party? You get a little buzzed. You do something you shouldn't do. And I was like, there's so many things wrong with what you just
yeah.
said.
Yeah.
If alcohol is going to prevent you from, it's going to be your excuse for sin, then that's a sin in itself. And why are you even drinking in the first place? But
yes.
to this person that was one of the few standout churchgoers that I even met, that was her level of awareness
yes.
that alcohol is a sin. And that it should be completely avoided.
Yes.
And also, another point, I don't know, wouldn't you say that the only real high ground that we have to deliver alcoholics is that we do not drink at all?
Right.
I mean, how can you say, I can drink, but
like
you need
can't.
To stop.
Yeah.
You have a problem.
Yeah.
And I've watched that intervention TV show about addicts, and their parents will have their liquor in their house. And they'll supposedly lock it up from the alcoholic, but they still have it in
and
their home.
It.
And that alcoholic will figure a way to get it. And they know that they've been raised to believe that that's acceptable to be drinking on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And then their parents don't even care enough about them to stop drinking and get it out of the house. It's unbelievable. And that's why we have a problem. Because it's not just our generation, it's the older generation that raised our generation drinking
mm-hmm.
and saying it's okay. And how
letting
can you tell your university student that it's wrong to go to the fraternity and sorority parties and drink and get drunk when they themselves are drinking at home?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, a very great deal of this started in the summer of 64. I remember it so clearly with the onset of the hippie rebellion, and there was a mild Christian response to the Summer of Love in 64 and Haight-Ashbury and so on, but Christians adopted a policy of not wanting to offend this generation, but be relevant mm-hmm. to this generation. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it went farther than just wearing long hair and dirty jeans and so on. It went toward a gradual feeling that the best way to relate to the world is to participate to some degree, mm-hmm. not only in the practices of the world, but even in the vices of the world. And tattooing is an example of that, but also hard rock music, liquor, and so on. All of these things have a way, once you let down your guard of being a peculiar people, and you say, well, I want to be like the world in order to save the world. I don't want to be a peculiar people person who's different from the world, who's judgmental, who's separate from the world. I like being part of the scene, and I'll have Jesus, and I'll also have the ways of the world. So the old-fashioned evangelical world that existed before 1964, which I remember quite well, passed away, and a new, compromised, and very much weakened mm-hmm. evangelical scene followed. Anyway, to conclude, all the more reason why we as Christians are to be lights in the world. Mm-hmm. When darkness shall cover the earth in gross darkness, the churchgoers and the evangelicals, then shall my light arise upon thee, and my glory shall be seen upon thee. Mm-hmm. We are to do our best to actually take advantage of the darkness in the church and the darkness of the world to put our lights as high, as conspicuously, as highly as we can, where all may see it and come to Christ. And this, of course, is a very, very redeeming thing, because we are not cast down and disheartened when the world becomes evil. We say, hey, this is an opportunity for the light to shine even brighter. Isn't that wonderful? That's what we're doing at truthtellers.org, and thousands now are coming to this light. Amen.
Amen.